Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton. This is News Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, why copper might become the most prized commodity of the 21st century and what a slowdown in supply would mean for us all, with news that a YouTuber sold a Pokemon card for $16 million. We ask, how can a YouTuber make that kind of money? Plus, the new man in the Fed is Kevin Warsh. We hear who he is and what it means for the Trump presidency and the US economy. You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, I was reading a piece about the markets this week in the context of how the markets have given a very lukewarm start to the tech stocks so far this year. And the piece was talking about investors buying the dip. Now, I just want to explain what that means. It means buying a stock after it falls, but with the expectation that it's going to go back up again, almost in a U-shape. And the reason I'm bringing this up to you is, if you ever feel yourself motivated to do that, you need to ask yourself two questions. One, why did the dip happen and is it temporary? And secondly, are you buying the stock just because it dipped or because you actually want to own the business underneath it? So the next time you hear of somebody talking about buying the dip, you will know the questions to ask to really discern value in that situation. Now, I was telling you all last week that I was recently in Vancouver in Canada. And while I was there, I was at an investing conference specialising in mining. And one panel discussion really caught my attention, namely one about copper. A report came out from S&P Global Energy a little while ago that quotes, every new building, every line of digital code, every renewable megawatt, every new car, every advanced weapon system depends on the metal. We thought this merited a discussion then here on Taking Stock. And I'm joined by Eric Onstad from Reuters, who has been following the copper market to help us unpack what this means. Eric, copper is the very enabler of electrification. And in the US for a quarter of a century, electricity consumption hardly rose year over year. But now that's changing at what could be around about 2.5% annually. What does this mean for the demand for the metal?
Well, yes, you're right. I mean, copper is prized for its conductivity, for electricity. So historically, it's been used a lot. I mean, it's used in, as you say, construction. It's used in wiring, in buildings. But now there's been a new demand for copper in, let's say, the AI data centers that are springing up, you know, like hotcakes all over. They all require wiring. You need them in electric vehicles. You need them for renewable energy, for every solar installation or wind turbine needs to be connected to the grid. So all of these, there's a new wave of demand for copper, and that's on top of what is already existing. We use them in the home. We use them in, you can see copper piping right in your home. So there is a big increase, and a lot of people are very bullish. I mean, some people say that it's gotten a bit out of control because speculators have piled into the market, but that's another issue.
Right. Well, and I want to explore the market as well for the price of it, but I just want to go back to the very basis of this, which is the increase in demand in electricity. I was reading the housing report that was published last year here in Ireland, and Eric, every house built this year doubles the requirement for electricity than a house built in 2019. And I'm guessing that's because we now have far more devices, there's now electrical vehicles, etc. So even before we add on the AI data centres and all of the other elements that you highlighted, is the demand for electricity at the most basic level within our households, is what is going on in Ireland representative of what's going on around the developed world?
Oh, definitely. Yes, but both in the developed and developing world. We have to be very global. And in fact, China is the elephant in the room for copper. More than half of all copper that's produced each year goes to China. And they have a huge amount of, as you probably know, they have their EV, electric vehicle industry is booming. So they're taking up a huge amount of copper, as is you know, other countries, Ireland, every nation in the developed world and developing world, we have to add. Yeah.
The developing world is where I wanted to go next, because there are many, many agencies around the world that is aiming to lift people out of poverty. I'm sure if I was to stop 10 or 100 of our listeners right now in the street and I asked them, do you think taking people out of poverty is the right thing to do? They would agree. Yet, if there is not enough of this metal being mined, and we'll talk about supply and how difficult it is to get it, but if there is not enough available, what happens then? So if we want to put electricity into houses where it's not there and there's not enough copper to do that, like, can we use an alternative? What happens there, Eric?
Yes, there are alternatives. And in fact, over the years, as copper prices have increased, there has been some substitution with aluminium. Aluminium is not quite as good a conductor of electricity, but it is a very good conductor of electricity. So we do have, we've seen overhead grid wires being using operators using aluminium instead of copper, and it's cheaper, but you have to use a bit more of it because it doesn't conduct electricity quite as well. The other another thing in the data centers, there's been a lot of, some people say, hype about copper in data centers, because other people say, well, you can also use fiber in the data centers. So there is a little bit of controversy over the extent of, you know, the copper demand. But I think it's generally agreed that copper demand is definitely going up. I mean, it's just an argument about the scale, really.
Well, let's then turn to where it's going to come from. Six countries are responsible for roughly 2/3 of mining production. And let's go back to the elephant that you referred to, namely China. Processing capacity is even more concentrated, where China commands roughly 40% of total smelting capacity and 66% of the imports of the main input, which is mined copper concentrate. So, Eric, I put it to you, where is the copper in the world?
So, yes, as you say, the three biggest miners for copper are Chile, Peru, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. And the one problem is that it's getting much more difficult to find copper, well, any kind of good copper mine. You can find copper, but it's only economic to mine if it's of a certain concentration. And the all the high-grade mines have really pretty much been discovered. So the companies are having to dig deeper. They're having to use lower grade, which costs more. And a second issue is that the countries that have these resources are, a lot of people say, understandably, wanting more returns from what is in their country. So you have, I mean, it's kind of, the moniker is resource nationalism. So countries such as Congo, Chile, Chile already has nationalized its biggest copper company many, many years ago, Codelco. You have many countries. Zambia has increased mining royalties. So it's costing more, both because of the underlying mineral resources and because countries say, well, we got to have a little bit more of the profits, you know, since it's our resources. So overall, the costs are going up, and that also feeds into the price when you see it on the market.
So when we think about resource nationalism, this came up in the conversation on that panel discussion in Canada, but it leads us to some very tricky conversations, because first off, as you say, the low-hanging fruit has been found. So what happens next? Do you go into more difficult places to reach? Do you displace people to get it? Is the world willing to tolerate a greater environmental impact to subsequently go on then and create electrical EV charging stations? We get now into some funny territory here, don't we?
We definitely do. And that's one thing the mining companies are definitely having to grapple with. I mean, you have indigenous peoples, people who live around the mine, saying, some people say we don't want it at all. Other people say, well, if it's going to be here, we need to see some benefits from it. So each mining company is very aware now. They each come up with a sustainability report each year. They trumpet what they're doing for the communities. A lot of some people say it's a bit of greenwashing. Other people say, well, they're having to do it. But no, there is a lot being done. They're being pressured to do these kind of things, just because people are waking up and saying, yes, we need a bigger slice of the pie. And the other issue you talk about, the environmental issues, that's another huge thing. Gone is the day in most places where a mining company will just go in, dig it up, leave toxic wastes, leave, devastation in its wake. The all mining jurisdictions that are responsible, you have to have a plan, you have to have a bond, you have to pay money to show that you're going to clean up. I mean, there are a few places, let's say in Myanmar, where there are militias who we get reports, and this is more tin rather than copper, but where they're digging up tin and using methods that are creating toxic wastes. But overall, the mining industry has really had to shape up. And that also costs money, of course. So that's another issue. But there's still controversy over not in my backyard, the Nimbo. We've had some issues where companies just are denied licenses because they can't get the environmental permits, or the residents say, no, we don't want that in our backyard.
Even, Eric, if we could get to the bottom of all of that and agree, even then, it takes 17 years on average for a new copper mine to go from discovery to production. So are we now looking at a chronic shortage at the very time that there are so many incentives in place to stimulate demand?
Yes, if you look on a graph, at the moment, there is enough copper around. The inventories are pretty healthy, although there's one glitch that because of the potential U.S. tariffs, a lot of that is in the States, and so it isn't available to the rest of the world. But overall, there's enough. But when analysts look to the future, you can see a graph where they show that there are deficits expected in coming years, and some quite deep deficits. So, but one caveat is that there are companies that are looking at the huge mountains of old tailings. This is the ore that has been processed, and that after you extract what you can, you put them in a big pile of unused ore. Well, in the past, the processing was not as advanced as it is now. So there are companies that are looking at using those and extracting much more than previously they could. So that is another possible source that could help any kind of shortages in the future. But it's still quite a challenge to find enough copper in the future.
It would be very easy, Eric, to listen to our conversation today and say, I must immediately go and buy some because the price is likely to rise. And if any listener was to go and do that, they'd be a couple of months behind everybody else who started doing that. The price currently is around $14,000 a metric ton, and that price has gone up almost a third since October. However, that's not just driven by supply and demand dynamics that we've been talking about. It also refers back to what you mentioned earlier in our conversation, which are the speculators that say, based on the data that we've been discussing, the price must surely rise. So how is the price of copper now relative to the fundamentals driving it?
Well, that is a very good question, because there's a lot of controversy over that. I mean, as you say, the copper has hit successive record highs. It hit a price above 14,000, a record. It hit several records before it hit that. Now it's settled down a bit, but there has been a lot of speculative interest. In October, when it first started its kind of ascent, that was pretty much because of people worried about disruptions at mines. There is the second biggest copper mine in Indonesia was temporarily suspended. But after that, people jumped in. You had, in fact, in China, which is another futures market. The main futures market is here in London, but in Shanghai, there's a futures market. And we hear that people on the street, just ordinary you and I, they are swapping tips on WeChat chat rooms. They're going online. And the amount of volume on the Shanghai Copper Futures Exchange in metals nearly doubled in January compared to December. So there is a lot of speculative frenzy and a little bit of people would argue some excess in the price. I've talked to analysts who say it may be around 11,000 to 12,000 if you looked at the fundamentals. Other people say, well, if you look to the future and the shortages, it could be more than that. But I think it's generally agreed that, yes, the price has probably gone further than it should be because of all the speculators jumping in.
Well, we can probably expect a small slowdown in that, given that the Shanghai Futures Exchange will be closed for Chinese New Year between the 13th and the 24th of February. That's not to stop the rest of the world, though, continuing with this. I think it's a fascinating conversation, Eric, because of the current nature of the price change, of course. But this is going to affect every home and business and government and country around the world in the coming years. And thank you so much for joining us. It's been a fascinating conversation. Eric Onstad from Reuters.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we ask who Logan Paul is and how he came to make so much money on YouTube. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now for my trivia this week. In February 1966, a group of banks created a new product that many of us, whether that's a person, a household or a business, might use. Think about it. What turns 60 this month? And I will give you the answer at the end of the show. Well, this week we learned that YouTuber and influencer Logan Paul sold an ultra-rare Pokemon card for a record $16 million. And over the last two decades, YouTubers have gone from hobbyists to full-on celebrities, making millions from the platform and the opportunities their profile gives them. But how do they make their money? I'm joined by entertainment journalist Olivia Fahey to discuss. So first up, Olivia, what is the business model of a YouTuber?
So essentially, there's a couple of different ways that you can earn money from YouTube. And it's actually probably one of the few ones that genuinely just gives you money based on your views. So if you are getting millions and millions of views, that means that more and more people are going to be exposed to adverts that they can push out to your viewers, which means the more money that you can make there. So that's actually probably one of the main sort of influxes of income that YouTubers can get. But then if you're also so popular that your videos are getting millions and millions of views, then that also opens it up to other advertising options. So you could have businesses paying you to put in a, you know, their own advert in the middle of your video, or you could have some sponsored links going on below. So there's a lot of different motifs for you to make money. But for YouTube, the main thing is the more views you get, the more ads they can push during your videos, and hence the more money you can make.
So Olivia, when people talk about the attention economy, this is what they mean?
Yes, pretty much. Yeah.
Because what intrigues me about what you're saying here, it's not that anybody has to click on something in order to pay you. All they need to do is pay with their attention. And then Google finds a way to monetize it via YouTube. And then that's how the chain of command passes through.
Exactly. So if you reach the level of subscribers and also monthly viewers on your account, you will then be eligible for monetization. So you need to set up an AdSense account. And basically, depending on how many views or what type of videos your followers are watching of yours will depend on the amount of money that you can make. So on YouTube, they have not only their long form, sort of the landscape, traditional kind of videos, which tend to be about 5, 10, 15, 30 minutes. They tend to be a little bit longer than what we're used to on the likes of Instagram and TikTok. But then they also have their shorts as well. So this would be up to 3 minutes is what they allow for shorts nowadays. It used to only be 1 minute and that was an absolute pain in the backside. But now they've upped it to 3 minutes. But because they are aware that the shorts, you're not really holding people's attention for as long. So any ads that do get pushed out during those videos, you don't actually earn as much for those as you would for the same ad playing during one of your other mainstream videos. So they are rewarding you for putting out the kind of longer form videos to hold people's attention for longer. And if you're able to do that, they can feed out more ads. And viewers may have even noticed over the last few years that not only is it an ad at the beginning of the video, which you can either skip or not skip, and sometimes they give you the option, sometimes they don't, there's also ones in the middle of the video now as well, or even a third or fourth time depending on the length, and you will have to watch at least a minute of that before you're even able to skip. Sometimes they bring up a next button and they bring you to the next ad if they've deemed that you've already watched enough of that one. But overall, the longer you can hold people's attention for, the more ads they can push to them, and hence the more money you're going to be able to make.
When we think today of content that one would consume in a platform like this, you've already mentioned two of them that we might think about, namely TikTok and Instagram Reels. Both of those models are based on a very short attention span, doing something dramatic to hold onto your attention in the first place. But it sounds like YouTube is doing the opposite. They're incentivizing people who can hold on to attention longer rather than incentivizing shorter form content.
Yes, and I think they were clever in the fact that they did bring in the shorts option because they knew that that's where the marketplace was kind of going. But at the same time, when it comes to, say, for example, if you were posting a video that is 20 minutes long, you would automatically say to yourself, okay, that's going to go up on YouTube. But then what you would do is that you would snip clips from it and then you would put them out onto your other social media accounts, be it Instagram or TikTok. And what I used to always find is that for, say, Facebook, if you were uploading videos to Facebook, anything between the kind of 2 to 3 minute, maybe 5 minute max would be kind of the engagement level that you'd find from viewers on Facebook. 90 minutes to 3 minutes would probably be the max on Instagram. Like 90 minutes or less is what you're looking at for TikTok. And then for YouTube, basically, as long as you can make it, that's where they're going to help sort of push you out there. And I think also in the way that they do their algorithm, if you've watched one video from this person, you're more likely to get, you know, fed their videos after that. But in terms of the way that they sort of calculate it is that on YouTube, different to way that people look for content on TikTok and Instagram is that you would actively search for these topics. You are searching for the latest Mandalorian and Grogu trailer. You're looking for, how do I put this piece of IKEA furniture together? You're looking for and using their search bar. So that way they're going to be able to learn a little bit more as to what you would like to see on your homepage, because you are actively searching for it and you're more likely to sit there and watch a video of a certain length if that is what you're actively searching for. On the likes of Instagram and TikTok, they are using an algorithm to calculate what kind of videos do you already watch and then feed you more of that kind of video. So you're actually less inclined to hit the follow button or the subscribe button on those platforms than you would be on YouTube these days.
And if we bring this back then to the development that happened this week about this card being sold for $16 million, how related is it the fact that the US YouTuber Logan Paul had YouTube as his primary platform in order to be able to generate that type of revenue for what it was? Is it because of who he is or because of what the card is?
Oh, it's a bit of both. And you're asking the right person for that. As a Pokemon card collector myself. So like, he actually bought that card for, I think it was only like 5.6 million, which in itself was a record breaking sale to begin with. So the fact that he has made three times that in this sale is insane. But for that kind of price, this card is absolutely so rare. It's like one that people have never even seen before. And also the way that he had it, like in the diamond covered case and things like that in the presentation, you know, all very ostentatious, and it looks expensive. So in terms of the price of the card, that's mostly down to the rarity of the card. But also Logan Paul has made sure to look after it. He's been able to kind of invest in its maintenance to make sure that it stays as valuable as possible. But for him, He started off on YouTube back in the day, like so long ago, and he has survived quite a few, shall we say, scandals over the years as well. So he has been cancelled and uncancelled so many times, I've lost count at this stage. And he basically made his money on YouTube. But then because he became so popular on that platform, other businesses started paying attention. And then he also started making some of his own sort of side businesses as well. So there's a lot of different ways that he is making his money today compared to when he started on YouTube. But he did start as a YouTuber. So that was where he started generating the money, and he was able to capitalize on his brand as a YouTuber.
Before I ask you anything else about YouTube, of course, I'm now going to have to ask you, why are you a Pokemon card collector? What's in it for you?
So I actually first started collecting Pokemon cards when I went to visit family when I was 10 years old, and they were already like mad into it. So when I came back home after that holiday, Pokemon wasn't in Ireland yet. So nobody had any idea as to what these things were. So I held on to them for 2 years until Pokemon came over here. So for me, it's definitely more like the nostalgic thing. So I haven't bought any Pokemon cards since the original 150 stopped being produced, essentially. Once they went past 150 and they started introducing all of these new ones, I lost interest. But I still have my 150 originals like in my folder in my closet, like that's where I have them. Not that I've looked at them recently, but maybe I should. I believe there's a card expo coming soon that I should probably be attending and getting it valued and things like that. But like that, it's like we're in an age nowadays when nostalgia is such a big part of what drives us and what keeps us going, because the world is on fire and anything that brings us kind of comfort is something that we're leaning more and more into. And, you know, like, Pokemon is still cool. They're still producing games. They're still producing TV series, and they're celebrating their 30th anniversary this year as well. And there's a lot going on around that. So, you know, I, for one, am still very proud to be a Poke nerd, you know?
Would you believe I didn't think it was 30 years? I really wouldn't have said 30 years. That is quite the statistic. Can I ask you about the careers that have evolved out of becoming a YouTuber? Like, if I was to interview you, Olivia, 30 years ago, I couldn't have imagined us talking about the job that a YouTuber would do, or people who would work in production in the area, or promotion in the area, or engagement in the area. I think it's important that we highlight to people the amount of work involved in actually being a successful YouTuber who's generating any type of revenue at all. Can you give us a sense of that?
Honestly, it's absolutely insane to think of where it's gone from to where it is now. And like you said, back in the day, you wouldn't have thought that being a YouTuber could be a career. But we've seen a lot of variations of different types of content creators who have made a success out of this. Of course, we've got the Paul brothers. We've also got Jacksepticeye, who's an Irish game streamer. And he started off on YouTube and has become one of the most popular streamers now. He's also on another platform called Twitch, which is specifically for gaming, game streaming and things like that. So he's become like an absolutely massive star as a result. Same with PewDiePie, who's a Swedish game streamer. So similar kind of motif as to how they started out. Depending on the way that you were, what kind of content you were creating, like there are people who started making web series online and they were put out on YouTube, and those series would then end up getting picked up elsewhere, The Guild being one of the most famous ones. So there's lots of different ways that people were able to sort of channel their creativity into creating something for YouTube, and it then spawned on all of these other different things for them. So it's insane. I never would have thought that it would be what it is today, but I know that while the rise of social media did definitely see people kind of move away from the platform in terms of where they thought the businesses and the money was going to go, but it just goes to show that people are still looking at YouTube, and especially for these longer form interests. And that's where I think the best monetization platform is still YouTube.
I presented a show on YouTube for 2 years, a couple of years ago. And what surprised me about it was not the level of depth and the preparation and the follow-up and everything that needed to happen. That comes as standard. What surprised me was the actual ability of anybody to use such sophisticated technology for free. So, for example, if you present a show live stream on YouTube, it's automatically recorded. There's no follow-up again or anything else like that. You can YouTube Studio is very elaborate in terms of the technology that's there about editing and so on like that. It has really democratized content generation and thus revenue generation, as long as you have got a monetizable product then, hasn't it?
Honest to God, it has. And that's the thing, like they've made it so that you can do everything on it. And while other platforms are still kind of trying to introduce that, YouTube was the first and is the one that has always been kind of designed for the creators themselves. Other platforms seem to just be introducing it once they realize that that's what it's being used for. But YouTube definitely spearheaded that this is for creators. And in the sense of, it's also kind of when you're trying to upload a video, it's basically step by step. It is all explained to you there. You don't need to be doing like a crash course to learn how to upload to YouTube. Like if you don't know how to upload to YouTube, you clearly haven't ever tried, because it's so simple to do it. You hit a button and then it tells you what the next steps are. Like, it's so easy. But they're definitely trying to make it as simple and as beneficial to the people using it as possible, which is kind of countering to other platforms who keep kind of doing all of these updates, trying something new. And it's like, it's changing so often that you never really know what version you're going to get the next time you go to upload to it. Whereas with YouTube, I think it's been the same for at least the last 5 years. The motif has been the exact same.
So if we were to look ahead then, Olivia, and we were to see where the future of this is going, because back 10 years ago, there wasn't Instagram Reels and there wasn't TikTok. I would argue that people who would look at YouTube, of course, they would have the competitor of, say, Netflix or anything else that they would look at on a flat screen. Where do you see the competition, in the broadest sense of the word, is going to come from in the future for the types of people who you were mentioning there earlier, who use YouTube as their primary platform to engage with their audience?
So that's a very difficult one to answer, because the one thing that I've noticed is that it's swings and roundabouts, essentially. You've got like the likes of all of the streamers that are coming out and they're like, oh, this is like streaming is going to be the future. But then you've also got a lot of the sort of cable networks, and they're now starting to look at the way that they're bundling things together. And then also the streamers are like, oh, well, maybe we'll start releasing like different channels on our streaming platform and things like that. And it's like, well, hang on a minute. If you're introducing channels, then isn't that exactly what cable television was? So in that sense, that's kind of doing a bit of a loop. And I think that's what's happening nowadays as well with the likes of YouTube, where, you know, YouTube was the main place where people went to watch things. Then they kind of went to social media, and now we're kind of looping back to YouTube again. So it's hard to say what is exactly going to happen next. But one thing's for sure is that video is still kind of the way of the future. And you're even seeing it with podcasts and the likes, that they are not only creating the audio content, but they're also producing video content as well. Netflix even released something recently that is a podcast, but it's a video series podcast. So it's mostly actually a video vlog kind of thing, as opposed to an actual podcast where you're just listening to the audio. So even in that sense, things are shifting in a different way. But if YouTube can sort of stay on top of these things, I think it still has, again, because it has people who go to it to specifically look up something, as long as they still have that as kind of their main draw in for their viewership, they should be able to work around anything that kind of comes to the future. So if it's lasted this long, I would predict that it will still have the longevity over some of the other social media platforms.
Well, listeners to Taking Stock, you heard it here first. Thanks so much indeed, Olivia Fahey, entertainment journalist, for joining us. And we know that if anybody would like to buy a set of 150 Pokemon cards, she's in the market for around about 16 million. This is Susan A's Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we look at what the American economy is going to make of Kevin Warsh as the incoming Fed chief. Welcome back to Taking Stock on News Talk. I'm Susan A's Cullerton. Well, one name you will be hearing a lot about and from is Kevin Warsh. He is Donald Trump's choice to be the next chair of the Federal Reserve, which is America's central bank. And I want to help you to get to know him better. So I'm delighted to be joined now by Victoria Guida, the economics correspondent for Politico. First off, Victoria, what do we know about him? We know he's a lawyer. We know that he has been critical of the Fed over the past couple of months and years, one could say. He's been a governor of the bank itself from 2006 to 2011. But what do we know about the man himself and the type of Fed chair that he's likely to be?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, he's previously served at the Fed as one of the seven governors. He was there during the financial crisis. And so he's somebody who knows how the institution works and has some familiarity with some of the staff and the officials there, but he has been critical. And so the question is, you know, to what extent is he going to be an institutionalist versus wanting to sort of overhaul things? And then also you have President Trump's calls for lower rates mixed in there. So he has a lot of competing things that he's going to have to address. And, you know, right now I would say it's a little bit unclear which Kevin Warsh we're going to get.
Well, if we think about the job that he has to do, he has to focus on two things. One is full employment. And of course, the data that's coming out of the US is quite positive in that regard. And then the other one is maintaining price stability or keeping inflation at or below 2%. And he has to seek to do both. So he would be described as an ideological hawk, which would mean that he would be more critical of inflation. He wants to make sure to keep that in check as distinct to focusing on unemployment or employment, I should say. What do you think when it comes to when you say we don't know which one we're going to get? What are you expecting?
Yeah, so great thing to bring up, because this is one of the key questions as it relates to Kevin Warsh of, you know, is he a hawk, right? So in the years after the Great Recession, he warned a lot about coming inflation, which never actually did come, even though the Fed kept rates very low. And more recently, you know, he started calling for lower rates, even though inflation has been above the Fed's 2% target for a long time. And so, you know, investors still think of Kevin Warsh as somebody who's going to be worried about inflation and not, you know, necessarily let it get out of control. But it's also been made very clear by the president that he picked Kevin Warsh because he thought that he would cut interest rates. Now, you know, luckily we have seen over the last couple of months, inflation has been cooling. And so there might actually be room to cut rates further later this year. Warsh is expected to take over the job in May. He hasn't been confirmed by the Senate here yet. But, you know, the question is, you know, is the economy going to cooperate? Because this could all work out for him where, you know, rate cuts are sort of the natural course of action anyway. But if we see inflation start to pick back up, the question is, you know, how much does he want to annoy the president right off the bat?
Well, if we go back to that decision that he was making back in 2009, and if we go back even earlier than that, when he started off in 2006, 7, 8, 9, let's just understand his point of view. He was worried about inflation long after the other governors of the central bank were. He was worried about inflation right up until April 2009. And when I was thinking about that, I thought, okay, by now Lehman's has happened, Bear Stearns has happened, AIG has happened, the bank guarantees that were happening in Europe had happened. The stock market just about had turned around in April 2009. And also quantitative easing was starting to happen in Europe. It hadn't, it was years off yet. But yet, was it that his job was, look, whatever's going on in the world, there's plenty of other people who were there to take care of that. The Fed's job at the time, whatever about unemployment, was to keep inflation in check. But many would argue that his take on that was wrong.
Right, because the inflation never actually did
exactly
show up, because the Fed actually kept rates near zero until they didn't start raising rates until December 2015. And even after that, it was, you know, very gradual that they started raising interest rates. And by the time the pandemic hit, which is when everything kind of scrambled again, inflation was actually still running below the Fed's 2% target.
And that's what I'm wondering here, is what was driving his decision making. And the particular reason I'm asking you this, Victoria, is he's making a big bet that productivity is going to increase, particularly due to AI. And certainly there's evidence of that. But he maintains that productivity going up means inflation can come down because it will cost less to do things. I'm wondering about what is driving that decision. And similarly, does that tie in with what was driving his decision making 20 years ago?
Sure. Yeah. So, as you mentioned, he's a lawyer by training. He also worked at Morgan Stanley for about 7 years before he went into policymaking roles. And so he's somebody who tends to think about the economy more from the perspective of sort of a financial market participant. Also sort of like anecdotal. You know, if you look back at the time that he was at the Fed, you can actually go through the transcripts of things that they were discussing. And he's not somebody who tends to lean super heavily on, you know, economic models, which, you know, all models have their flaws. But it's a very specific perspective that he has. And so one of the things that may be driving his analysis is the fact that he's somebody who is very in tune with how markets think about things, as opposed to maybe how economists think about things.
Well, on that note, what does the market think of him? How has the markets reacted to this announcement?
So markets are, we've seen yields actually go up. And one of the reasons is that, you know, people perceive Kevin Warsh as being slightly more hawkish, as we were just discussing, than somebody who, like Kevin Hassett, who's a Trump advisor who was also in the running for the job, and he was seen as sort of just like somebody who would be more likely to just do whatever President Trump wanted. The other thing to know about Warsh, and this has been sort of a consistent theme of his for, you know, about 15 plus years, is he also wants to shrink the Fed's financial holdings. And that's something that, all else being equal, I mean, it depends on how he might pursue doing this, but that could make longer term interest rates go up, which could make, you know, mortgage rates go up and things like that. So markets are sort of trying to parse the extent to which Kevin Warsh is going to pursue these reforms that he's talked about for a long time.
If I'm to unpack some of the things you've said there, higher yields means it would cost the government more to borrow. It means that investors who are lending to the US government want a higher return in order to compensate them for the risk of which they're lending to the government in the first place. And as you say, yes, that then can be passed through when it comes to higher interest rates, indeed for anything, mortgages or otherwise. And we are dealing with the fact that the government there is borrowing immense amounts of money. So therefore, Kevin Warsh can't afford to be overly hawkish or be overly threatening in terms of increasing rates, can he? Because he is not dealing with the same size of a balance sheet that he was dealing with 20 years ago.
That's exactly right. And actually, one of the things that he's talked about over the past year is wanting to do more cooperation between the Fed and the Treasury. And, you know, people think that maybe one of the things that could be into that is, that it could go into that, is wanting to ensure that anything the Fed is doing doesn't unduly raise the cost of borrowing for the government.
Easier said than done. Easier said than done. Can I ask you what that really means, though? Coordination between the Treasury and the Fed. What does that mean for the man and woman who's walking down the street today in Washington?
So it's somewhat unclear. I mean, Warsh is somebody who has a lot of lofty ideals. He talks a lot about reform. But a lot of his plans, he hasn't necessarily fleshed out in detail. And, you know, some of that may be on purpose. You know, here in the U.S., we think about, you know, nominees, like you think about Supreme Court nominees, and they, you know, often don't say what their opinions are on things. And so it's possible that Warsh, who's known for a long time that he wants to be Fed chair, has wanted to give himself some flexibility. But the way that he has framed it is basically that he wants to give markets more certainty about, you know, what kind of debt they might be looking at, right? Because if you think about this gets a little bit into the weeds, but the supply of debt that's available for any of us to buy, right? Like, we can all invest in treasury bonds. The supply of that is determined by how much treasury is issuing and what it's issuing and how much the Fed on its end is snapping up. And so basically what he has framed it at is kind of like, you would give markets more certainty as to what's coming on the debt if the Fed and the Treasury are sort of working together on this is what we're going to be doing.
If you look at the size of the balance sheet of the US government before the global financial crisis, Victoria, it was looking at around about $1 trillion. It went up to $9 trillion during the pandemic, and it's now back down to 6.5. But that's still 6.5 times where it was 20 years ago. Two letters that I have seen associated with Kevin Warsh's name are QT, quantitative tightening. And that is where he would take what you've just said, which is that if there is going to be less debt available in the markets, doesn't then that mean that there would be less cash moving around the economy?
Yeah, so this is one of the reasons why, you know, he wants to, as, you know, as we were discussing, he wants to shrink the balance sheet, or he's talked about wanting to shrink the balance sheet, but there are limitations to that, because the way the Fed used to set interest rates before 2008, before all those reserves flooded into the system like you're talking about, they used to set interest rates in a different way. And so now, if you tried to shrink the balance sheet, you would have a disruption where you're completely upending and trying to go back to the way things were. And so there might be limitations on how much he can actually do to shrink the balance sheet without causing market disruptions.
And of course, his job isn't just to manage the markets. It's also to, like we were saying earlier, it's also to deal with unemployment, etc. And we've spoken a lot about Kevin Warsh, the man, but I'd just like to talk about him now in comparison to the current Fed chair, namely Jay Powell, because Jay Powell has always said, look, I'm going to look at the data, as much of it as I can, close enough to the decision-making time frame as I can, and make decisions accordingly. Kevin Warsh, on the other hand, is saying he's going to be more policy-driven. How do you see the differences in their chairmanship style affecting the decisions that are subsequently going to come out of the Fed?
Yeah, so one of the big things that Warsh has talked about is the Fed has gotten into something called that they call forward guidance, where basically they give signals about what they're going to do with rates at coming meetings, right? And it's always couched in sort of central banker speak, but you can figure out what they're trying to signal. And Warsh is somebody who thinks that the Fed talks too much. He thinks that they give too many signals about what's coming, and that they comment too much on high frequency economic indicators like, you know, the monthly jobs report that tell you how many jobs have been added, the inflation reports. And so that might be a really big shift if he decides to start providing less information and, you know, just lays out sort of a strategy, right? Because the difference of what you were just referring to is Powell always talks about being data dependent, which means that, you know, people tracking the data can potentially plot out how they think the Fed is going to react based on how the economy is developing. And for Warsh, it sounds like, you know, it might be much more of an overarching strategy of this is the direction we're going, which has pros and cons, right? It gives more certainty, but it also potentially makes it harder to pivot.
One last thing that I'd like to ask you about, Victoria, is any time on this show over the past year we've talked about the central bank in the US, one topic comes up a lot, which is the dispersion of views. And if you ever wanted a quantification of that, you could look at the dot plot, which is where the governors feel inflation is going to be and thus interest rates in the future. How is he, do you think, going to manage the relationships that he has with the governors and thus the unity of the organization looking ahead?
Yeah, big question, because, you know, the way that the Fed works is rate decisions are made by committee. There's actually 19 people on the committee. Some of the votes rotate, but 12 of them have a vote in any given year. And, you know, we've seen a lot of disagreement within the committee in the last few meetings about, you know, where the economy is headed, whether there should be greater concern about the labor market or greater concern about the fact that inflation has been above 2% for years now. And so if he is going to make the case for rate cuts later this year, as, you know, is he's expected to do, because again, that's what President Trump has said that he expects him to do. He's going to have to really make a compelling case that that is what is best for the economy to convince his fellow officials. And, you know, it's kind of a tricky job because there's all these questions around what I just said, which is that President Trump expects him to cut interest rates. And so there might be some level of suspicion as to what his motivation is. I think he'll have to like win people over.
And I think, Victoria, he has to manage inflation, unemployment, Trump, dispersion, coordination with the Fed, the man has some job description. It'll be intriguing to watch this. Thank you very much indeed for joining me, Victoria Guida, the economics correspondent for Politico, about a topic that we will talk about many times in the months to come.
Thank you.
Now, for the answer to my trivia. In February 1966, a group of banks created a new product that many of us, whether that's a person, a household or a business, might use. What product do you think is celebrating its 60th birthday this month? Well, the answer is the Interbank Card Association launched what became MasterCharge, later renamed MasterCard, and its 60th birthday is this very month, in February 2026. Now, that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast, first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Kate Henshaw. Hugo de Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day. And I already look forward to chatting to you again next week.